Blog Talk Radio.
One, two, three, four, come on. Does the life of a poet, does it have to be sad? Midnight in the Greyhound, it doesn't mean that much. Now, I don't care who you are married to, we will fall apart. There'll be the soldiers and you on the battleground. Battleground.
Bottom Up Radio Network. That was Nick Jaina's Battleground. Perfect song. Rob Rousey with me, my man?
Yes, sir. Excuse me.
Fucking A. Shit.
Yeah, I got a mouthful of a burrito there for a second.
Nice.
Yeah, you know, colonialist food.
We had the fucking baked tofu with ginger and garlic and rice.
Mm.
I made it.
Nice. GMO tofu, you know? We had this big discussion about, modern veganism and or vegetarianism and its reliance upon soy product and how 80 to 90% of this country's soy is owned by Monsanto or some other such genetically modifying company. And, we were just having a discussion about sustainable eating and which is better, eating local meat and raw milk and eggs or staying vegetarian. And, a friend of mine asserts quite intelligibly that veganism is a first world privilege. And I agree with that. I think it is. But at the same token, I would also say it's more necessary in the first world as well. But if the consumption of food is a greater impact than it needs to be, simply based upon ideology and morality. This really has nothing to do with your dinner, by the way.
Yeah, thanks for stealing my thunder. I just wanted to fucking talk about how I made some good shit. And that's interesting you say
that sounds good, you pig.
Hey, way to to go, white man, and your fucking little gourmet fucking tofu bullshit. Yay. So there was this guy that I saw an article about in the Portland Mercury here in town. And he's a butcher, and he butchers his own meat. It was a really interesting story because he opened up a restaurant and all this. But he was a hardcore vegan, hardcore practicing vegan prior to becoming a butcher. And he, he later obviously started eating meat again, but he just really conscientious, you know, farming, kind of Joel Salatin style. And said he actually felt like he was doing more for animal rights in his capacity now as a butcher than he was when he was a vegan, because now he's very much involved in networking different cooks and chefs and butchers into kind of building this network of conscientious butchering and that kind of thing. And that's it's really interesting. As a vegan, he didn't feel like he was doing. And I think Robert, you said something to that effect a while back. You just recently started eating meat again, right?
Yeah, and it definitely had a there's many facets to food in our culture that we don't take into account as being relevant. Like, the spiritual aspect of eating is a tribal has a tribal history to it. Coming together to eat and share in the fruits of the day's labor. It has a very spiritual connection, and a lot of the stories in every religion across the board revolve around metaphors of food. Or there's also a lot of restrictions and a lot of focus on food for the spiritual context there. And so beyond just the economic impact or the political impact, the spiritual impact of what we eat and how that affects us is important, as well as the health aspect. And when we began to eat meat, it was the first time in a many number of years that I felt spiritually connected to my food. And I also felt a bioregion connection to the food, which really actually enhanced a lot of health effects that I hadn't found before eating non-local food that was health food. You know, I mean, the spirulina, wheatgrass, all that crap. Yeah, it's really healthy. It's really good for you. But I mean, I think much like old homeboy that wrote the Omnivore's Dilemma. You know, he's saying that yes, you know, organic spinach in a bag is really good and healthy. But when it comes from California and you live in Massachusetts, it really doesn't make any sense because it's soaking in diesel. And I think that has a profound spiritual effect on us as well. So when we started eating meat, it really did affect us in a positive way, and made me feel more connected to the, Elton John song from Lion King.
Dude, you know, fuck Patrick Friedman, his attitude against the Lion King, because that shit is profound.
Dude, that's like it's up there with like Different Strokes, you know, the TV show when we were kids. Like, you know, it's fundamental and to the development of our generation.
And by the way, listeners, anybody who's just tuning in now and wondering what the heck was that name drop of Patrick Friedman, that's the whack job rich fucking grandson of Milton Friedman that we had on the show weeks ago. It was my idea to have him on. I thought he sounded interesting. I thought I could sign on for a lot of the stuff I'd read by him was peripheral and I was really into. And then we had him on and he showed himself to be a fucking whack job rich kid. And when Rabble Rouser was calmly and relaxedly explaining the cycle of life, which Patrick Friedman wants to escape, he used the Lion King as a reference, and Patrick didn't get the joke, which really wasn't a joke, but kind of was. And
well, it's always a joke when you reference Disney as your academic reference. It's always
a joke. Exactly.
But the fact that you have to use an academic reference when talking about the cycle of life to a grown human being is also pretty much a fucking joke.
I just want to live forever. Like, I just want to live forever and like fucking space and like eat stars. Like, all I care about stars is if they feed me.
Dude, I'm gonna live forever. I don't know about you, but I'm not dying of aging, dude. Oh, what a boot in the ass that guy deserves.
Jesus Christ. Oh, fuck.
But yeah, back to the topic at hand. Yeah, I do feel much healthier. I also eat less. now, and I, you know, it's funny. A large group of our friends have recently made this paradigm shift into being omnivores, and it's made for some really amazing discussion and dinner parties. And it's also you really have to be more conscious about your food. You know, I find myself asking more questions when I go to markets about, you know, where the food comes from. And it's amazing, you know, when you find a farmer that does humanely, I don't even say humanely, because that's such a fucked up egocentric word. Like, when a farmer who actually just has animals that live on land in a free manner and a healthy manner, they're very proud of that. You know, they're extremely proud of it, and they're loud about it. They're excited. They get excited about the food. They get excited about the process of butcher. They get excited about the life of the animal. And you know, it's a pretty amazing experience once you really get into it. It's much like what when you first get into vegetarianism or veganism does for us for vegetables. You know, you get really excited when you cook these amazing meals, and you find the new vegetables and the new seasonings. It's much like that, but I think there's something about it that seems to be more complete. Like it's the end of this progression of some sort, where you come full circle back to, you know, doing what you naturally should be doing. It's amazing how privileged we are that we can focus on our food.
Yeah, no shit, right? You know, like I mean, I suppose that, like, you know, it's one of those things where it's we've gotten so separated from it, you know, and it becomes a matter of just appreciating food as it was just accepted, you know, long ago. I think we're kind of, we're becoming, to a certain degree in our culture, reconnected with our food, which is good because we understand, you know, you can develop understanding, I think, based of other people and their plights based on your relationship with food. You know, the mass overproduction of fast food and that kind of thing is what really separates people from the world around them and to other people. And it's subtle, but, you know, like when you're – like I know that being with my wife, she's – you know, when we first got together, dude, fuck. I think when we first got together, I was on a three-month Coke binge and ate a lot of fucking pizza. And –
Coca-Cola or cocaine?
Dude. Both, bitch. And so anyway, I had this fucking mountain of pizza boxes in my goddamn kitchen, dude.
I want to hang out with you on cocaine. That's hilarious.
So I had this fucking...
I want to play a really fast game of D&D with you on coke.
No shit, dude. It would be a fucking, like, hour, one-shot dungeon crawl. And we'd be moving so fast. We'd be hugging. I'd be like, I love you, man. You're fucking great to play D&D with. You'd be like, you know what? I never thought I'd like it, but I totally do. Because I love you, too. And we'd handshake. And then we would sober up, and we'd forget about everything. You know, that's what we
right,
do. That's
right.
What drugs. That's what those types of drugs do for you. Anyway, so you know, so I get together with my wife, and slowly, she's been patiently over the course of the past 5 years has been really encouraging me to make shit and make food and really be more involved in it. And you know, I just think that the fucking general your general perception of reality gets a good boost when you start really making stuff. It's like. When we had Joel Salatin on, he talked about going to the food bank because they had 1,000 pounds of fucking sweet potatoes sitting there. And he's like, how the hell do you have 1,000 pounds of sweet potatoes sitting here at a food bank? And they said, well, people don't want that. You know, the people who come here just want the packaged shit.
The thing we have to realize, too, just to bring back the rhetoric of smashing capitalism, is that this culture we live in this economic system we live in, because we live in an economic system, we don't live in an ability to obtain our own food or barter for food or however people used to eat food. We have to work so much that food has become secondary to life, and it's become something we just have to do to get through the day. And so it's always quick and easy. That's the big sell. It's like it's quick, it's easy, and they even have like frozen vegan entrees, like Amy's vegan entrees that are frozen. It's like you pop them in the microwave for, you know, 3 minutes, and then all of a sudden you got this amazing vegan meal, and it's like, well, yeah, but you just spent 3 minutes doing one of the most important things that any animal does in the daily basis, you know, obtaining energy. And when you start cooking, you realize – I have to give a big shout-out to all my peeps here in the Northwest who've been coming over and cooking with us, because we spend 2 or 3 hours preparing a meal, and then we spend another hour and a half eating that meal. And, I mean, that, if you think about that, that's 4 to 5 hours out of a day surrounding around eating a meal, but it's 4 or 5 hours out of your day that you're taking for yourself. The boss can't have it. You know, the TV doesn't get it. The transit doesn't get it. You don't get it stuck in traffic. You have 5 hours with your friends and your family, and it's absolutely amazing the things that you can create and come up with in that 5 hours as far as conversation and ties that are created between you and your comrades and your friends and your lovers. And you know, it's just plain enjoyable, you know.
I don't know, dude. I get fucking bored with people after like an hour.
Yeah, you're a hard one.
90 minutes tops. And I'm like, yeah. Jesus Christ, shut up.
Now, you know, tonight's episode of Burn is only going to be 90 minutes long, everybody.
You know, like, this whole thing I've been really thinking about lately is the idea of cooperation and mutual interaction amongst the human animal. And that, you know, it's just so natural for us. And I think that we have set ourselves up in a place via, you know, state capitalism and corporatism and this kind of consumeristic, heavy, heavy dependency on consuming, that it's given this whole fucking emphasis on, you know, I'm really into individualism, but there's been this massive spike in this kind of isolationist thing where people are like, they're fragmenting. So it's not just, it's a relation, our relationship, I think, with everything is, our relationship with food has become really detached. Our relationships with each other have become really attached and, detached. And, you know, one of the big things I've been just really thinking about a lot over the past few weeks is this idea that, you know, it's just an exciting possibility, when people ask the sort of red herring question of, you know, in the absence of the state, how do we take care of our roads? How do we do, all the basic questions? And the first thing I say, and I get excited, is we're going to do that with each other. You know, fuck, now we have a real reason to go across the street and knock on our neighbor's door and meet them and shake their hand.
Or take a bus across town to hang out with one of your best friends.
Ew.
Oh, that's why I was laughing the whole time you're talking about this. You're like, the last couple of weeks I've been really thinking about it a lot, how, like, you know, people can connect and actually connect in, like, a real time and, like, hang out with each other in person and get to know each other. Like, I'm really thinking about that a lot, thinking about it.
Dude,
you know, it's something that's really on my mind a lot lately. Why would that be, Travis? Huh?
I'm
putting you on the couch right now.
I'm talking about my neighbors across the street. my neighbor across the street is not a 30-minute bus ride away, and that's the bottom line.
Well, you know, when we lived in Missouri, we were with our neighbors across the street nearly every night there for a while. I mean, it was first of all, it's the concept of being in your home or outside is a really big difference. And when you cruise around the streets in any setting, any urban setting now or suburban setting, you don't see people outside. We're not a culture that sits on our porch and hangs out in the backyards. And it's becoming more that way. People are starting to spend more time in their neighborhoods outside. I'm not talking about going on nature walks and things like that. I'm talking about just hanging out in your space outdoors and being visible. And our neighbor did that every day. He sat out in his backyard. You know, he's a professional man. He's a school teacher. But every day he'd come home and he would spend just hours in his backyard sitting by a fire and, you know, just hanging out in his backyard. And he'd wave to all of us. And we became good friends that way. And we spent most of our time on our porch. I mean, in the summers, our door never even closed, let alone locked. And we spent most of our time on our porch or with open doors. And it makes a huge difference in the security aspect of your neighborhood and in the ties that you build across political spectrum, across class, across race. I mean, just all across the board, if you start spending more time outside, just in your neighborhood, I think, you know, it makes a huge difference. It makes you visible, number one. And when inevitably the feds come and kick down your door, you're going to have neighbors that are going to stand in resistance with you. And I think that's an important thing.
So we've got an interesting comment in chat by someone named The Ozone. Welcome to the program. By the way, we have a few people sitting in chat. I want to welcome everybody to the show. Appreciate them hanging in. I want to respond. I don't know if this is serious, but there's this person, The Ozone. I'd love for you to call in, too.
Oh, my God. No, Ozone, don't call into our show. Ozone, I know Ozone as of old. He's a Zionist apologist.
Oh, snap, it's that guy?
Yeah, it's that guy. What's his comment? What's his comment? Go ahead and read it over the air. Give him his due.
Says, if you were for individualism, you wouldn't be trying to force your beliefs on all society.
By the way, everybody, Byrne is now in the homes of and consciousness of every single person in society at this point.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not a specialized show that people choose to listen to because they're interested in discourse about these subjects. It's actually forced upon everybody at this point.
Exactly.
So.
We've actually gone North Korea on everyone's asses and installed little fucking radios inside their houses that only broadcasts our show on a fucking loop. So we are now officially forcing our points of view.
Right. And I'm really tired of victims forcing themselves upon their attackers. You know, I'm really tired of people who are being attacked forcing themselves on their attackers. Like, I just think that people need to stop defending themselves and stop fighting for what's right.
Just agree.
Why do you have to be so confrontational? You know, just get attacked. Okay? Like, duh. I don't get it.
I don't get it either.
Such fascists always fighting for their lives.
Fascists.
Who do you think you are, you know?
Who do I think I am? Apparently I'm forcing. I'm a forcer. I am an enforcer. I am a coercive agency unto myself.
I do want to touch on that. You did say individualism, which always strikes me as odd. We should discuss maybe the ideas of individualism, because I don't agree with individualism. I think that individualism is a failure to exist in a way that you seem to talk about existing, peaceably cohabitating, those kind of things. To me, I don't understand. When I hear individualism, I think of the rugged individual, and I think of the cowboy, and I think of, you know, the do-it-yourself everything. And I don't agree with do-it-yourself. I think we should do it together. I think that's a fundamental difference. So, you know, in punk rock, DIY has been an ethic in punk rock since the beginning days of punk rock, do-it-yourself. And what that meant was doing it outside of the context of mainstream, doing it without without financial capital, doing it in a way where you have 100% contact with your product from beginning to end. And that's a punk rock ethic that I have gotten from years of being involved in punk rock. But it's never do it yourself. That's the funny thing about it, is in nearly every situation it's a collectivist idea. The entire groups come together and do it as a community. So can you explain what individualism means to you? I'd like to hear about that.
Well, for me, it's understand that I'm not I tend towards kind of a both and paradigm. In my opinion, subjective opinion, the individual is kind of lost without the collective, and the collective is kind of lost without a set of individuals thinking independently, thinking for themselves, to whatever degree, being masters of their own destiny, innovating in whatever. So I think it's a little bit, it's both and. I don't, in matter of fact, I was thinking about this the other day. I am at my essence a voluntarist, and what that means is that I want what I want for myself might be different from, say, even yours, Rabble Rouser, but I want with equal passion for you to be able to live how you want to live without anybody fucking with you. Okay, that's essentially
right.
That's
so it's
what
like
I
collectivized
want.
Individuals, like.
Well, I mean, it's a little. I mean, it is a both and thing, and I think one of the problems, and not just, and this isn't just anarchism. This is in politics, and this is in fucking sports. I mean, Jesus Christ, is the sense of. Fuck that thing. It's all my thing. It's all red state. It's all blue state. No, it's left anarchy. It's right anarchy. And I tend towards more of a. I think we're better off when we start looking at people that we disagree with and taking in what we can, because it can balance us out. You know, like I wouldn't have considered myself to have any kind of primitivist leanings a few months ago, and then I started reading some primitivists. And do I agree with everything? No, I don't. I fucking don't. That's cool. I'm not going to try and convince anybody otherwise, because why the fuck would I want to do that? I don't give a shit. Just leave me alone. But I can read it and go, wow, man, I really dig that. I really dig that. You know, I don't approach any of these things from some stark ideological perspective. I don't like to do that, because then I'm just inherently limiting myself from the greater world of knowledge. And so individualism to me means being master of your own destiny, free to opt out if you want to, as long as you're not hurting anybody else, free to opt out of any kind of community or social arrangement or whatever if you choose to. But understand with the understanding that at your own peril if you set off by yourself. You know, do I think it's possible for dude to go out and live in the woods totally by himself and never be part of a community and be, yeah, sure. I think it's a much better life to live in a community with other people supporting one another simply because that's kind of the tendency of the human animal. And that's biology, people. That's fucking evolution. So the stark individualist is not really thinking reasonably because a community is a collective and there is a collective consciousness and there is those things there. But it's also the other. It's made up of individuals. And if we forget the individual, then we at our own peril. But if we forget about community, you know, it's at our own peril.
Right, and I think there's also a drastic misunderstanding from people who don't live in collective situations or don't know about them or have an understanding of them as to what that entails. A lot of people from the outside of the anarchist understanding think that, you know, collective living means that we all agree and we all sit and we study the same things and we have this dogmatic set of principles in which we live by, and that's just not the case. Now, but what is the case is we do have one set of principles I think that works really well is that, and like you said before, it's my view is that the most effective collective, which, and I know that rhymes, and that's kind of fun, is the collective who is conscious of the individual and the individual is conscious of the collective, meaning that any action the individual takes understands that that's going to have an effect upon the collective. And when the collective makes a collective action, they're conscious of the individual and of their comfort zones and their safety. For instance, there's a lot of discussion about race ethics in anarchism. And, you know, a lot of decisions are made by white males. And there's seems to be a misunderstanding by a lot of white males as to why there aren't more people of color, women of color, and these things involved with actions, a lot of the anarchist actions. And it's not to say that there aren't people of color and women and transgender. I mean, these people are a large part of the anarchist community. But what tends to happen is the decisions of confrontation, for instance, with police are made by white males because white males don't have the same understanding of police repression firsthand a lot of times that people of color and people more marginalized people in society have. That's not to say that they're making wrong decisions. It's just that decisions that they make might affect different people differently. So we have to take those into consideration when we ask who's going to come along on these certain actions or whatnot. Those things have to be brought to mind, you know. I mean, bottom line is that a person of color is going to receive harsher treatment from this system than a white male in almost every case. Now, what's interesting then about if you look at the Green Scare is it's mostly white men and women in the official Green Scare. Now, that's of course not to say that there's not a large part of indigenous peoples and people of color involved with environmental take back actions, because there are. In fact, I was just at a talk at PSU about this group called Take Back the Land Miami that is predominantly black people, and their leadership is intentionally, by mandate of their own group, at least 51% women of color. And the reasoning for that is that women of color have been the most affected group of people by the foreclosure crisis and housing crisis historically and in modern times. Therefore, women of color should be in a position of leadership to lead the insurrection against these things and to lead a backlash against that. And it makes great sense. And, you know, a bulk of the questions to the man who was giving the talk was, what's it like to take leadership from a black woman? And it was mostly coming from white women who were asking this. And they were at the same time enamored and really kind of floored by this idea. I don't consider it to be anything out of the ordinary. I'm like, well, yeah, I mean, taking direction from a black woman is just the same as taking direction from anybody who has a position that needs to be directed to people. You know, it's like, yeah, sure, if that person has reason to direct or delegate certain ideas, then we have to listen to them because they're the one doing it. But to some people, it really is a phenomenal paradigm for them. They cannot understand what that would look like. And that's a pretty interesting thing to think about.
Totally. Totally, man.
That's a lot of talking. Sorry.
Hey, no, that's great. Actually, you know, that... no, just what you were talking about, just kind of the interconnectedness of people and, you know, and caring and sharing is caring. I want to play a clip for everyone. This actually happened this week. It's kind of intense, but it's only a minute and a half long, so enjoy. We'll be right back in just a minute.
Tragedy in the heartland today as a 17-year-old honors student burned alive after being hit by an out-of-control speeding car. A grisly death only TV host Glenn Beck could deserve. According to police, a car driving over 70 miles per hour in a 25-mile-per-hour zone struck young Rebecca Bunton as she was bicycling down a quiet street in Olathe, Kansas, shattering her rib cage and not Glenn Beck's, tragically pinning her legs, not his, to a retaining wall. Calvin Dale lives just a few blocks from the scene of the accident.
I heard screaming, and I thought it was just someone doing an accurate impression of Glenn Beck talking normally, but then I saw the smoke.
EMT Craig Anton was first on the scene.
I jumped out of the ambulance, and I ran to the wreckage to make sure that the victim was still breathing, or else was Glenn Beck.
At this impromptu vigil, friends said Rebecca was a lively girl with a bright future, a good friend who hated Glenn Beck and loved to dance.
She was just a normal kid. She wasn't some fat, dumb Mormon fuckface who should have drank herself to death when she had the chance. She was so beautiful, she didn't even have little pig eyes.
Among those expressing their grief and confusion was the victim's mother.
There is no harder thing than to have Glenn Beck outlive your child. I would give anything for this to have happened to Glenn Beck instead. Glenn Beck.
The terrible tragedy hits especially hard following the Rottweiler mauling of someone besides Glenn Beck in Milwaukee yesterday and the revelation that Glenn Beck was not the man trampled to death at a street carnival in Rio de Janeiro Sunday. Moving on, Reebok has introduced a line of full-body sneakers.
Oh my God, that's great.
Fat face Mormon who should have drunk himself to death a long time ago.
She didn't even have pig eyes.
Oh, good times. Dude, there is an awesome argument going on in chat. I wish you could see this rabble rouser. It's Black Talk Radio and the Ozone are going at it about
hey.
What to do.
About what?
About what it like what a Jew is for real, and it's pretty awesome. Ethiopian Jews they're talking about. This is pretty cool.
Yeah, Black Talk Radio is great. What's up, Scotty? Welcome to the show. I'm glad to see you around, man. Black Talk Radio has started this great initiative. I remember when we first started on Blog Talk Radio so long ago. Black Talk Radio had just started the show, too, and in this time, he's built quite a huge network. Scott, if you want to call in and talk about what blacktalkradio.ning.com is and what that all does, and that would be great. It's an autonomous network of black media, but it's autonomous in that it's all I would like him to talk about it, but it seems to be all administered by black men and women, but I'm a part of the Black Talk Media Network. I'm on their Ning. I get their updates. We participate in discussions together. So it's not separatist in any way whatsoever, but it gives strong voice to a group of people who have, you know, historically been marginalized and deleted from the media voice, except for when it's, you know, somehow convenient or useful for the white capitalist system to make use of them, and they're fighting against that hardcore. So glad to have you in on the show.
Yeah, and you know, again, as Robert Rosler said, please feel free to call in, tell us about what you're doing. That'd be pretty awesome, man.
Unless your name is Ozone.
He says, yeah, unless your name is Ozone, in which case, please, Jesus. Pun intended.
You know, I don't really care, Ozone. Ozone, if you want to call in, I don't really give a shit. You can call in. I'm not going to waste time arguing with you, though. I mean, we'll quickly hang up and start being a douche.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we accept all callers are welcome. So, I mean, Really,
we had Dr. Friedman, for Christ's sake, and we asked that guy to be on. So.
Yeah, seriously, I actually emailed him several times and developed a dialogue. So, let's talk Civil War, because we promised a Civil War would occur on Burn tonight, and so we should talk Civil War. Rabble Rouser, do you want to start talking about American Civil War? What made you want to start? What made you want to have this as a topic tonight?
Well, okay. Well, actually, what brought this to my forefront of my ideas for tonight was I went to this this talk called Take Back the Land that I talked about just a moment ago, to the Black Run Initiative out of Miami, squatters' rights. What they do is they steal houses from the bank that are empty, and they give them to people who need houses, and then they defend those people by barricading in front of the house when the cops try to take them away. It's a pretty awesome movement of people. And there was a pretty great turnout at PSU for this event. My daughter was there with me, and she enjoyed everything that they had to say. She was a little bored, but she said I was bored, but when I explained to her, you know, in real simple terms what it was, that they're stealing houses from banks and giving them to real people, she was like, oh, well, that sounds right. Well, what he said was he was in his opening talks, he said that one of the things he made that really caught my attention was that this was the end of legal slavery, and then he started talking about reform and what reform meant. And he started quoting the first Ghanaian Republic president, who said that reform is basically what – I don't know exactly what the quote is, but it's basically along the lines of reform is what violent regimes do when they see themselves falling out of popularity and they know they're about to die. It's the last thing that a government does to stay alive, much like getting an Obama presidency. It's what a controlling regime will do is they will reform in so many ways to make people endear themselves to them again, even though they're still the same violent regime. And that's what the Civil War has – we've talked about this with – I've had this talk with many circles, radical circles, be they socialist, Marxist, Leninist, anarchist, about the Civil War, and there still seems to be this prevailing idea that the Civil War was a honorable war against slavery. And it's simply not the case. If we look, in fact, it's a war for the enlargement and enrichment of slavery through industrial capitalization, period. There's no two ways about that.
That actually, this might be a good opportunity to play a short clip. It's it's from a guy named Thomas DiLorenzo. He's done a lot of work about Lincoln and Lincoln's attitudes towards slavery. It's really short, but very interesting. So here it is.
Yo, why should we break up if we keep making up? I mean, let's just stay together.
Dude, so I have no idea what the fuck that is.
Yeah.
That is not the fucking clip I loaded up.
Okay.
Let me try one more time. Hang on.
Yo, why should we break up if we can't make it?
That's so lame. Anyway, it was a really interesting clip about how Lincoln didn't really care about slaves, and it was more state decision, and it was really interesting, and...
Yeah, Lincoln said many times that if they can maintain slavery, if maintaining slavery meant the incorporating the South and saving it into the Union, then he's all for that. So he was fine with the slave states. And people, another misconception I think that we'll talk about, because I know you're really well versed in these ideas, is that there were two economies at the time. People keep saying that this is a nation run with two different economic systems. And that's why the war came about. I can't say that I agree with that. I think they were the same economic systems. It's just one of them offered the tenets and ideas of freedom for all while controlling everything, and the other one controlled everything and didn't at all mask its ideas of what of freedom for all. I mean, just no, nobody's going to be free.
So we have a caller in line. I think this might be our cat from Black Talk Radio. Whoever it is. You are on the you're on the wire with us. Hello, caller.
Hey, this is Scotty from Black Talk Radio. How you doing?
Hey, Scotty.
What's up, brother Scotty? How you doing, man?
Hey, I'm doing fine. Just working hard as always, listening to your program while I'm doing so.
Nice. So what brings you on tonight, Scotty?
Well, your topic, you were talking about the American Civil War, and so that's why I tuned it in to see what y'all were talking about. But I agree that the Civil War, that's like, you know, you hear conservatives talk a lot about revisionism as far as history goes. That's revisionism of the way they try to portray Lincoln as the great emancipator. He did so out of necessity and for a number of external factors. They needed the manpower of the slaves, the freed slaves. And also, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, it was France, I believe, or it might have been another country in Europe who was supplying the Union Army. They made it conditional, you know, that's what they wanted. Yeah, we'll help you in your efforts, but we want you to abolish slavery. And then you had the abolitionist movement also. So Lincoln was for the most part, forced into it.
Absolutely. Well, and Lincoln also was tied in quite heartily to a lot of what would now be called Wall Street banker robber barons, who explained quite clearly the benefits of capitalist slavery versus an indentured slavery. And, I mean, what better way than to turn the entire populace into economic slaves? I mean, you could have slaves and use their manpower under the ownership of a few specific farmers, or you could have the entire economy under the slavery of industrial capitalism. And it just made more economic sense to enslave everybody.
Well, you know, and everybody knows that a war is highly, highly profitable to a small group of people. It always has been for thousands and thousands of years. It has always been a highly profitable adventure for a very small few. You know, particularly the American Civil War provided fertile ground for the robber barons specifically to make a shitload of fucking money. You know, we're talking a reduced we're talking an eliminated workforce, 600,000 people dead, plenty of room for child labor, so you got cheap labor. There's plenty of room for exploitation. I mean, it's unbelievable. You can get away with whatever you want. The state's gonna do lots of deals with you because they've got a country to rebuild. Because again, 600,000 people dead.
Yeah, that would be the equivalent, but their population of the time, by the way, that would be the equivalent of about 6 million Americans dying today in a war.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
So just imagine the size of, let's pick a city that's around 6 million. I think New York has 8 million. So Manhattan, Brooklyn, and the Bronx collectively have about 6 million people. Imagine all three of those boroughs completely being wiped out and decimated. And I wouldn't mind so much if most of Manhattan was decimated. But,
right.
and I don't think I'll get much argument about that at this point. But you know, in a serious note, that's a large amount of the population to lose. And then this is further proof of how far the state will go, what they're willing to risk, what they're willing to lose to gain control. It's not about freeing anybody. It's not for the safety, protection, pursuit of happiness. It's none of those things. It's literally about control, and they're willing to risk all of the pawns on the chessboard just to win the game. And that's what we really have to start thinking about is not just the state. It's actually beyond the state at this point. It's how the state is used by capitalist bankers to control every aspect of society, and they're willing to kill you to control and dominate the resources of the world.
But guys, let me ask this question both you and Scotty. If it wasn't capitalist bankers, then who would it be? I mean, if we were willing to allow any room for the state to exist in the first place, I mean, if capitalist bankers won't they just be replaced by trade unions and doctors' associations or other fucking organizations who will scramble?
Well, there would be no. First of all, there would be no need for trade unions if there weren't the system that we have set up now.
I disagree, man, because people have been trading for thousands of years well before the advent of state capitalism. I mean,
absolutely, people have been trading for thousands of years, but capitalism requires – go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, you know, informal networks of traders absolutely emerge, merchants who knew each other and worked together and developed relationships. I mean, that's
but
that's
a consolidation of resources into the hands of so few. I mean, let's take
Unions, I'm thinking about, you know, a group of workers for a corporation who come together in order to fight for better benefits, higher pay, and things of that nature.
Right. And, well, and to look at this, Travis, from a historical perspective, unionism, labor movement, didn't begin until immediately after the Civil War, when the entire nation was industrialized. And upon the industrialization of the entire country, we started seeing the control of about 100 families controlling all trade in the world, controlling every
right.
aspect. And we're talking about Western conquest here. We're talking, you know, this is we're talking about the state we're living in right now. Oregon was a fuel point for that because of the logging industry, the timber industry, the railroad industry. All of these things required a massive amount of control, and slavery just extended its arms to not be agrarian but to be industrial. And at this point, we didn't just have agricultural slaves. We had railroad workers working, you know, 18 hours a day for a pay that they couldn't even afford to buy their own housing, so they had to live in company housing, and they were indebted to the company store, which is exactly the form of slavery. In fact, let me read this quote by – there was a Southern farmer who pre-Civil War – was talking to in a paper that he wrote, was talking to congressmen from the North, and he said, let me see if I can find this really quickly. Oh, la, 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 la.
I have oh, shit, the Zionists left the show. God damn it.
Of course. Okay, okay, here it is. George Fitzhugh, In a book called Cannibals All, just before the Civil War, said to Northerners, quote, "You, with the command over labor which your capital gives you, are a slave owner, a master without the obligations of a master. They who work for you, who create your income, are slaves without the rights of slaves." It's a really interesting quote because he uses the term without the rights of slaves. And, you know, it's something that, yes, while slavery is a horrible and disgusting and deplorable thing, it's amazing if you think about housing, food, those things had to be provided because they were systems and tools of industry at the time. They had to be maintained. And with capitalism, we have to maintain it ourselves. We have to work all day for the boss and then still figure out a way to house, clothe, feed, and insure ourselves, health care. I mean, all of these things. Slavery just broadened itself. It really did. And the bankers figured out you couldn't profit from the millions of slaves that this country had because they weren't economic warriors. They weren't on the battlefield of the economy. They were the marginalized.
Well, they were for the states that wanted to secede. I mean, that was economically viable for them in that one.
No, they were used as a tool, but they weren't consumers. This,
sure.
In an industrialized capitalism, you exist sure. upon consumption and productivity. They were producers, they were workers, and they were exploited, but exploited people aren't exploited wholly if they aren't consumers and exploited in their consumption as well.
No, I mean,
so we're
like
exploited now in consumption and productivity.
I completely agree with you, and what you're describing is true of real and happens. What I'm just saying is that. I just find there's a lot of, specifically, it's anti-capitalist rhetoric and anarchism, and I get it, fine. My position is, I guess, a little bit different, because what I hate the most out of all the things that we hate and we talk about on this show is, and I hate it with a virulent passion, that I now have to smoke so much pot to just fucking keep myself from being really significantly angry, is I hate the state. I hate it to such a fucking degree. I don't think any social system, any economic system, any of them, no matter how great they sound on paper, no matter how great we see them occur in little tiny spots, none of them are safe if the state exists. To me, the state is the bane of banes. It is the most corrosive thing that we've come up with as a human animal. And all this bad shit is also, all in my eyes, directly related to the existence of this organization. And I feel like within anarchism specifically, there's a lot of, I see a shitload of crushed capitalism. Yeah, I fucking get it. You don't like capitalism. I get it. But I see
the deal is we're dealing with those who own and control the means of production, consumption, and own and control the means of control. And that's what the state is. The state is the arm of moderately controlling and mediating between the masses and the rabble and those who control. It gives those on the bottom the ability to think that they're playing an integral role in the outcome of their own lives, giving them the vote, giving them the ability to have protests, to have social uprisings, to get reform. But all it really is a way to keep us distracted from the ideas of who really has the control. You could smash the state all day. You can get rid of the state, and it'll reform in different ways. But if we don't take down this idea of ownership and this idea of manipulation and financial control, if we don't delete that from our vocabularies as being a valid system, then we're always going to have that level of control, and it might not be the state, but it will always exist.
I disagree, but I want to get Scotty's viewpoint on this. Scotty, what are your thoughts?
Well, I'm sorry, I kind of blanked out there, but when you were talking about marijuana, and earlier you were talking about slaves, you know, I kind of connected the two because the way that the war on drugs, which is entirely a state creation, which was started under Richard Nixon, and how that war on drugs is used to secure new slaves for the new plantation, which is the privatized prison industry.
That's right.
Absolutely.
We hear all these people talking about America stands for freedom and we are beacon of light for others, a beacon of democracy. Well, how is it that in the land of the free it has the largest prison population than any country on the face of the earth? And
freedom ain't free, Scotty. Freedom ain't free.
I know, right? Yeah. Yeah, we free to be slaves and make money for the top 3% in the country,
right,
who control everything. Yeah, if you want to talk about being free. But, I mean, do you guys think, though, there's a big push now, and California looks like it may become the first state to totally decriminalize marijuana, which, by the way, I had read this article on the Intelligence Daily's website where they were saying how many, every 45 seconds somebody is arrested for simple marijuana possession. So our jails are filled with people for just simple possession of drugs. And I just think, you know, people say that slavery doesn't exist or America abolished slavery. Well, actually, they never did. They said it was legal as long as you were being punished for a crime. And so then we have the state making up laws and stuff against natural plants like marijuana and criminalizing it and then, you know, privatizing our prisons, which then is making money for these corporate stockholders and politicians.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, people don't understand, too, that the prison industrial complex isn't merely profiting from what happens inside the prison and the economy of a prison, which is huge. I mean, we're talking about feeding a million people a day, three meals a day. Somebody's getting those contracts. Somebody's making hand over fist money just off of those aspects of the prison complex. But what's interesting, when towns – and when go back 25, 30 years – towns would protest and come out and be enraged if a prison were going to be opening close to the town.
Right.
This was something that the whole town was against. Now you actually have town hall city planners making videos as to why a prison should be in their community, why their community is ripe for a prison. And these things are hilarious.
They're
you can actually find them online.
They're just looking
absolutely.
At tax revenue. But interestingly, though, I think that with education and just the circles that I run in and some of the programs I listen to on public radio, there's beginning to be a outcry against these privatized prisons because I mean, it's just bilking the taxpayers. The taxpayers are the ones who are paying you know, for these private companies to get these contracts with the state. Well, who is the state? In a sense, the state is the taxpayer when you're talking about revenue. So I think people need to wake up to that fact that as our prisons grow larger, like you said, it takes a lot of money to feed and house these people. And so that's coming out of the pocket of the taxpayer. Now, do you really want somebody, do you really want to spend thousands, tens of thousands of dollars a year for someone who simply had a blunt in their ashtray or something, or had an ounce of weed? It makes no sense.
Right. Well, you know, if on morality alone, I'd rather pay for that than pay that same amount of money to bomb a poor village of brown people across the country, across the world. But that's not really an argument, because I completely abhor the prison system. I think all prisons should be abolished, which should lead to our next topic of discussion is, if slavery exists, who are the overseers? We have the largest plantation in the world at this point, and we have overseers. What is the overseer at this point? You know, are we our own overseer? Police.
No.
You know, the police are rampant in our streets. They're violent. They have assumed the role of the overseer of the largest plantation in history.
I would say the police are the slave catchers. I would say they are the slave catchers, not necessarily.
Yeah, that's the position of the overseer, though. They ride around the plantation. They punish you if you do something wrong. They're the ones that are in charge of going out and bringing back the slaves that escape.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, KRS-One has this really great line in his song "Black Cop," where he uses the term overseer, and he says, "Yeah, officer from overseers, need a little clarity, check the similarities." And he goes through all the similarities of the officer to the overseer, and then he repeats the word officer until it turns into the word overseer. He's like, officer, 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 yeah, overseer. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, I think that you know, when talking about insurrection in the streets, talking about a social movement of uprising and a social justice movement, we have to take into account what the first line of defense of the state's going to be, and that's going to be the police. But once we have that understanding, we're really just attacking a symptom at that point. We're attacking a symptom of a much deeper-seated problem that's not going to go away. And that's what I think the state is. Yeah, the state's horrible. I abhor it. I want it to go away. But, Travis, I don't think that the state is the root of the problem.
Well, here's why I disagree with you, is because the state has been around well before capitalism was invented as an economic formation. Well before, okay? Well, I'm talking like ancient fucking China, and where it was just an emperor and a couple of his sons and his, like, 10 wives or whatever, and it was just them and their military, okay? That capitalism didn't exist then. We've got lots of evidence that suggests that corporatism does not emerge in the absence of the state. It does not emerge in the absence of the state. You need an organization. One of the most important ingredients for corporatism to flourish is for a coercive agency to be at the center of the social strata that can forcefully monopolize land, can forcefully monopolize security by forcefully extracting revenue from the citizens. It needs an organization like that in place to begin with. So then they go and they start getting the favors. This is proven in lots of ways, including Derek Jensen, who we've had on this show, in his book, Railroads and Clear Cuts. The different logging companies he goes over, they got their land via the state. They didn't buy it. They had shitloads of money. They didn't fucking buy it. It was given to them by the state.
And you're going to get no argument about that, but while capitalism may be a new idea, it is the predominant controlling economic force. Now, my underlying premise for the hatred of capitalism goes beyond capitalism into the hatred of money, into the hatred of the ideas of profit, the ideas of placing false profit upon something to garner control over anyone and everyone who has need of that said resource. And just the simple idea of calling the things that we need to live by resources inherently means that you control them. That's just a control tool right there. To call anything a resource is to say that it's there for your use and your use only.
Yeah, but that's a really
so it goes
narrow,
way
that's
beyond
a
capitalism.
Super,
but
dude,
capitalism is the predominant system right now. Capitalism
sure,
in America is – so that's why you're going to hear a lot of rhetoric against capitalism. If we lived in a socialist state, you would hear anarchist rhetoric against socialism. if we any form that the state is going to use for its economic control, you're going to hear anarchist rhetoric against it. The state, yes, may be one of the most powerful forces, but my question is, how is it then that these companies and these all of these destroyers and rapists of the planet act outside of the bounds of the state so often? And they still would be destroying the planet if not for the state. They would just be doing it on their own terms.
They're,
and they would be doing it with their own private armies. And they have in the past, they are right now, and they'll continue to do
that. That's a complete fallacy, Robert. That's a complete fallacy. They don't ever operate outside of the state. It's ridiculous. They work with these motherfuckers. They own these motherfuckers. They own the
government. Whoa. How much money in fines do these companies have to pay every year, which is fine for them because they make so much more profits, but they're okay with paying the fines. They act constantly outside of the confines of the state. They're constantly breaking their own laws. They're constantly going against the treaties set forth between the companies, the corporations, and the state. Every day these companies do that.
Dude,
so the state
okay, first of all,
is just a mediation between them and the people.
I want to correct your language because they're not paying fines. They're just paying their dues, all right? They're paying their fucking rent, all right? When you go to, when you look at the economic collapse of Argentina in 2001, the people standing in front of the banks with guns were state cops, not private armies hired by these corporations, not like Blackwater. Blackwater is paid for by the federal government. It is subsidized. These are not private armies.
No, absolutely. But that doesn't mean they wouldn't exist without it. For instance, how many slaves are there accounts of slaves who turned over other slaves to get a few extra pieces of bread? Harriet Tubman said it herself. We could have freed so many more if they'd only known they were slaves. So that argument doesn't hold water in saying that the state is the all-powerful force here.
Absolutely.
The people will inherently protect their master if they think it's going to get them a little bit extra awards from their master. But the master is clearly not the state. The master is clearly the economic system. The state completely was overturned. The economic system crumbled. The state was overturned. This states come and go. States fall repeatedly. Regimes change. The state disappears. The state reemerges. But what's constant in all situations of control is the economic system.
That is absolutely incorrect because you're assuming that the same economic system has been in place for 10,000 years. It has
it
not.
Absolutely has because it's the same people that have been running it. It's the same bloodlines, the same fucking families that have been running the game economically for 10,000 years.
So you're telling me these motherfuckers are related to, like, Chinese emperors from thousands
of
years ago? Oh, come on.
Absolutely.
That is maybe, like, spiritually or, like, in this kind of vague way, but, like, what are they, fucking aliens? What are these, V? Is that what are they reptoids?
Hey, you're the sci-fi freak, not me. You put it together. All I'm saying
is if you
track back to the system of control, it's the same families that have had control. It's the same fucking people, Travis.
I don't know about 10,000 years
ago. I would say 6,000
history. I would say in the history of the United States, probably even going back to England, because they had their roots in England. So I would say that absolutely
totally
has been the case of a few families, these bloodlines who have been ruling America. I mean, were you surprised when Lynn Cheney said that President Obama was Vice President Cheney's eighth cousin? Were you surprised at that?
No, not at all.
Even look alike.
I'm not arguing in any way the bloodline goes to the royal family. I don't deny that those kinds of bloodlines.
Oh, wow, flip flop.
John Kerry on the show, everybody.
What I'm saying is
I never denied that Bush and them weren't related to the fucking royal British bloodline. What I did deny was the assumption that for 10,000 years it's been the same set of fucking people. No, it's been the only thing is what I'm arguing that has been constant.
I was mostly joking about the bloodline thing. That was the David Icke joke.
No, you weren't. You were serious.
Fuck up. No, but what I am serious about is it's the exact same economic system of control. It's the idea of hoarding resources. It's the idea of a threat of scarcity, and that exists with or without the state. That exists as an economic idea,
of that because you only see that psychological motivation in the presence of the state.
No, you can break it down to microcosms of the family, Travis. You could break it down non-existent from the state. You can break it down in families. You can break it down in small communities. And it's not necessarily the overwhelming, overpowering burden of the state upon these people that create this infrastructure. It's there. It's when we start placing profit, false profit on things, placing economic value on certain items, and allow for certain people to control those things, we're going to have a system of hierarchy. And the state could be the vicious arm of that system or not. It doesn't matter. As long as that economic hierarchy exists, we're, number one, going to be raping, destroying, and pillaging the planet, most importantly. But number two, beyond that, we're going to be controlling each other's movement. And that's the function of the state, but that's not because the state exists. If you smash the state tomorrow, these bastards are still going to be destroying the planet willy-nilly.
No, because they can't. Look, dude,
well,
in the absence
of... Travis, are you telling me that they actually care about law and order?
Dude,
Are you pretending these people actually respect the people? You
got to hear me out, dude, because in the absence of the state and in the absence of just something as simple as the Federal Reserve, they don't have any money to do what they do. They need
these systems to be in place.
They control... For 100,000
they don't need
years.
The money if they have resources access.
But how do they
resources?
Get the resources?
They already have them.
That's the point, Travis.
Ideologically, your argument is sound, but we're not dealing with the ideological paper argument. They already have the resources. They are on the land.
You blow them the fuck off of the planet.
That's how you
dude,
take them
no,
away.
No, because they'll be back faster than you can say fuck the state.
Oh, well, now who's into science fiction?
You come back. They always come back. Don't you watch the sequels? Yeah, no shit. Have you seen the Matrix trilogy? It just happens over and over and over. What I'm saying is that for 100,000 years, we were tribal, and the state didn't emerge. Corporations, corporate structure did not emerge. It emerged.
Right. And we also, at the same time, we're not destroying the planet to the degree
absolutely.
We have been in the
absolutely.
Last 250 years. And that's the point of contention.
Here's what I'm saying, is that if there was a button available to me, that if I pushed it, the state as an organization would be gone tomorrow, I would push it in a heartbeat. And the reason for that is because in an instant, the second I push that button, all those protections go away from all these fucking multinational corporations. The banks don't got cops in front of them. All these guys can actually be
held accountable. In the movie The Future of Food,
a friend of mine was telling me, I got to see this movie. Apparently, it's really fucking good. One of the people in it scooted back and forth between the EPA and this food company, back and forth and back and forth and back and forth, because the EPA creates laws that protect these guys, that protect these companies, so that we can't hold them liable.
Who was the one that came up with the EPA? Under what administration did the EPA emerge? Under Nixon. It's the same administration that invented the welfare state as we know it, using HUD as a tool of spatial deconcentration. The exact same administration that did that, the same administration that implemented the war on drugs, the same administration that privatized prison systems, the same administration that used, for the first time in history, privatized companies to completely destroy entire Indochina villages with their experimental chemicals. Yeah, those things are horrible and disgusting. What I'm saying to you, Travis, is there's if the state disappeared tomorrow, that's not to say there wouldn't be the cop mentality and there wouldn't still be cops standing to defend their masters, because that has existed with or without the state since the beginning of the hoarding of resources. If you control the resources, you control a large part of the people who will kill each other. Jay Gould said it himself. He said we can hire half the working class to kill the other half. Now, that's not legal, but he did it. He attempted to do it. And this is how these people think. They don't think along the lines of what is allotted to them by the state. They just use the state to garner what they need to garner for the public eye, but behind the public eye, outside of the view of the public lens, they'll continue to destroy, because they are diseased, cancerous type of people who think that it's okay to destroy this planet. And the state is merely the way that they use to let people think that they have a part in this. But without the state, they would still do this.
No, they wouldn't. It's not possible.
Are you assuming that there's state legislators and there's There's lawmakers who are there as they just as they completely blow the top off of the mountains in the Appalachians, and these people play an integral role in that destruction? Absolutely not. Is there a vote to say whether or not it's okay to remove these mountaintops? Absolutely not. This is not state regulated. The people of the Appalachians are across the board against this, yet this continues to happen. So it's not the long arm of the state. It's not the tool of the state used to allow this to happen. It's mere greed and control that allows for this to happen.
It
would happen with or without the state, Travis.
The state? No, you have no evidence of that. You've got,
Scotty, please. For a second. I kind of agree with Rabble that it would happen absent some governmental body that we call the state, because you still would have these little fiefdoms and these little kingdoms set up by families who control most of the resources in those local areas. So while we wouldn't have this big giant entity we call the federal government, I do believe something would replace it. It would just be broken up into smaller little fiefdoms.
I mean, they definitely wouldn't have the freedom to use state employees as their personal private armies. They'd have to have their own armies, which would go into another form of slavery yet again, which is
not
at all inconceivable because they had that before.
Look, dude, people do shit if they're getting paid. And if you take away a coercive fiat money system, a mode of trading that is enforced on an entire populace, if that goes away in an instant – What are these people with this?
It's not the state; it's the economic system which needs to be dismantled. The state
was dismantled. Did the Zulu kingdom under Shaka Zulu not set out to conquer all of the neighboring regions, and they weren't under a capitalist system?
Right, and they would not exist today. And they don't exist under the same terms they exist.
Well, dude, the Chinese emperors of 9,000 years ago, that wasn't a capitalist system.
Capitalism isn't the only problem. Capitalism is merely the name of the current economic system of hoarding that we have today.
No,
so, like I said before, it's
problem.
Not just capitalism, but capitalism is what we have in existence today that is the problem. If that goes away, another economic system pops up that gives name to the greed and the corruption of a large – actually, I can't say a large part. I would say a small part of humanity, because it's a small part of the people who are destroying the planet. It's a small percentage of the people who control everything. Your average person doesn't have any interest in the destruction of the planet, the murdering of innocent peoples, because they don't profit from it, and they never will. So they don't have vested interest in that. So it's a small percentage of people who have vested interest in the destruction of this world that are profiting greatly from it.
That actually lays a good groundwork for a really awesome clip. It's just a few minutes long. I think you guys will really enjoy it. It's about the nature of empires. This is Eddie Izzard. So we're going to take a little break. We'll be right back.
So, yeah, so we had empires. In Europe, we had empires. Everyone had France and Spain and Britain and Turkey, the Ottoman Empire, full of furniture for some reason. And the Austro-Hungarian Empire, famous for fuck all. Yes, all they did was slowly collapse like a flan in a cupboard. And the German Empire, very organized, always build an empire. Einstein, build an empire, very Prussian. And then they'd celebrate with the World War and then lose the whole fucking empire by the end of it. In the 30s, Hitler, Czechoslovakia, Poland, France, Second World War, Russian front, not a good idea. Hitler never played Risk when he was a kid. Because, you know, playing Risk, you could never hold on to Asia. That Asian, Eastern European area, you could never hold it, could you? 7 extra men at the beginning of every go, but you couldn't fucking hold it. Australasia, that was the one, Australasia. All the purples, get everyone on Papua New Guinea and just build up and build up. And Hitler ended up in a ditch covered in petrol on fire. So that's fun. I think that's funny. Because he was a mass murdering fuckhead. And that was his honeymoon as well. Double trouble. Hey. Ava, let's marry him. Where should our honeymoon be? Well, in a ditch covered in petrol on fire. I've already arranged it upstairs. Oh, how romantic, Adolf. Yes, I know. Fun. What a bastard. And he was a vegetarian and a painter, so he must have been going, I can't get the fucking trees. Damn, I will kill everyone in the world. And he was a mass murdering fuckhead, as many important historians have said. And but the other mass murderers got away with it. Stalin killed many millions, died in his bed. Well done there. Pol Pot killed 1.7 million Cambodians, died under house arrest, age 72. Well done indeed. And the reason we let them get away with it is because they killed their own people. And we're sort of fine with that. Now help yourself, you know. We've been trying to kill you for ages, so you kill your own people. Right on that. Seems to be. Hitler killed people next door. Oh, stupid man. After a couple of years, we won't stand for that, will we? And Pol Pot killed 1.7 million people. We can't even deal with that. I think, you know, we think if somebody kills someone, that's murder, you go to prison. You kill 10 people, you go to Texas, they hit you with a brick, that's what they do. 20 people, you go to a hospital, they look through a small window at you forever. And over that, we can't deal with it, you know? Somebody's killed 100,000 people. We're almost going, well done, well done. You killed 100,000 people? You must get up very early in the morning. I can't even get down the gym. Your diary must look odd. Get up in the morning, death, 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 lunch. Death, 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 afternoon tea, death, 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 quick shower. You know, so I suppose we're glad that Pol Pot's under house arrest. You know, 1.7 million people, at least we know where he is. Under house arrest. Just don't go in that fucking house, you know? I know a lot of people who would love to be under house arrest. They bring you your food. You just stay here. All right. Yeah. Have you got any videos? You know, you just sit there. So, and Pol Pot was a history teacher, and Hitler was a vegetarian painter. So mass murders come from the areas you least expect it. I don't know how the flip comes over, but it happens. So, yeah. So there was...
All right, that was Eddie Izzard fooling us.
I think that when talking about empires, what we have here is not a state empire. It's an economic empire. I think that needs to be recognized, Travis. I think whether or not you agree with this economic system and how it could possibly be salvaged if the state disappeared, we do have an economic empire. It stretches across the globe. It's not reliant upon any one single state, and that state will fall if that economic empire chooses that state to fall.
I would agree in the sense that we have a world culture that has a specific collective psychological proponent, which is that force.
Wait, saying there's a world culture, that's assuming that all of the world shares this idea.
Okay, well, I'll use what I mean to say, and you're right, thanks for pointing that out. What I mean to say is more like what Quinn points out, calls our culture, and by our I mean mother culture, Western culture, civilization as we know it for the past 10,000 years. And I won't deny that there is a specific mode of behavior that stretches back to about 10,000 years ago, and I agree with Quinn's assessment that it begins with specifically the hoarding of food, well beyond what's needed, i.e. you have 50 mice, give them food for 100, eventually you'll have 100 mice. The more people there are in a certain spot, the more minds, the more innovation, and the more the illusion springs up that this is the best way to be and we must protect it at all costs. I absolutely agree with that.
Well, go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt.
I'm kind of baked at this point, so I don't even know what I was going to say. I guess I'll go ahead.
I would say the question of, we have anti-statists, and then we have anti-civ. Two distinct groups of insurrectionaries, one of which takes part across the wide spectrum of people. You have right-wing anti-statists, you have left-wing anti-statists, you have militias that are anti-state, that really just target the state and want to bring it down. They're on the FBI terrorist list, pretty low, maybe 12, 13 on the list. Number one on the FBI's target list is those who wish to bring down the industries that destroy the environment and animals. And ALF and ELF are the two top targeted groups by the FBI as the largest domestic terrorist threat in history. The most manpower, the most money, the most resources is devoted to bringing down environmental eco-terrorists, is what they call them, even though it's quite clear that the eco-terrorists are the ones who destroy the ecology, not the ones who are saving it. But terrorism in our language today can easily be flipped and defined as those who defend themselves or defend others. It's easy enough when they say Palestinian terrorists to understand that terrorism actually is a word switch for defenders, because the Palestinians are a defensive force. Just by being Palestinians, you are inherently being attacked and you are on the defense. So, but they're called terrorists. So eco-terrorists, which much easier to be described as eco-defenders, are number one on the FBI's hit list. The state is attacking them first. Now, these are not anti-statists. They probably are in ideology opposed to the state, but their actions reflect that which opposes the economic development and destruction of our planet. And they're number one on the FBI's hit list. Explain that. Explain why this all-powerful state targets first and foremost those who oppose the economic development and destruction of our planet, as opposed to targeting those who are against the state.
That's easy. Is that the people who are willing to blow up a tractor, who are willing to fucking break some shit. Again, it's the image of the armed police officer standing in front of the bank. Okay, you don't see that until the people show up at the bank to claim their shit because they've been ripped off. And so the people who are simply against the state, the criteria of, oh, well, if you're not on the fucking terrorist list, then, clearly you're not doing anything really effective. Clearly you're not. I don't think that's a fair criteria.
Timothy McVeigh took down a whole building in Oklahoma, and Ted Kaczynski had the largest, most widespread manhunt in FBI history.
Sure, absolutely, because they were fucking actually, they were, because, you know.
But my point is, Ted Kaczynski.
And it's the same thing, but you know what, if you want us to talk about Ted Kaczynski, then fine. Let's talk about the fucking Washington, D.C. sniper who was shooting people. That was a massive manhunt. And he was a fucking dude who was just shooting.
It was
normal.
It was nothing in comparison to Kaczynski's manhunt,
number
one.
But what I'm saying is that, hear me out. Because if your criteria is having lots of cops after somebody, then, dude, yeah, there's plenty of shit. That can't be the only criteria. And I'm not trying to downplay that because I'm really
fucking... That's definitely not my only criteria, but that is a definite signifier that where the loyalties lie of the state. The loyalties don't lie in self-preservation. The loyalties of the state lie in the preservation of their master.
It is the preservation of their special interest groups. And if it wasn't big business, it would be
different
groups.
No, it's not their special interest groups. It's vice versa. It's vice versa. Just as the cop standing in front of the bank doesn't have any vested interest in that bank other than he knows that if he protects that bank, he's going to get his special pittance.
Right, and if the state didn't exist, those cops wouldn't be standing in front of the bank so the people could fucking break down the goddamn doors and get their shit back. That's what I'm saying, is that if the system was not in place for those cops to be standing there in the first fucking place, then those people could storm the fucking bank and get their shit back.
You don't think they would simply just hire private guards, as we've seen in the early, with the early robber barons, some of the corporations, their names escape me, some of those prominent families, but I mean, what was it, Pickney guards and stuff that were used to put down labor and stuff like that? Those were people that were just hired
the
by the corporation. Yeah, the Pinkertons, yeah.
I have an easy answer to that. Is that central banks are necessary to the state and especially necessary to big business to amass huge amounts of wealth. And without central banks in place, which are a product of the state, by the way, is fiat currency is a real, real old economic practice. It's the whole fucking golden egg, golden chicken egg shit. And without any of those things in place, these guys have nobody. There's no money to use. Even with the robber barons, when the government
the state is a very powerful tool used by these people, but it's definitely not the basis of control. It's in no way whatsoever. It's a tool.
If it weren't, they would just
make laws to make it that we have to eat McDonald's three times a day.
But
a law.
Can you really separate the two groups, especially when most of your representatives up there in Washington are millionaires. So can you really separate the state from...
But there are the rogues. There are the Cynthia McKinney's to get in. She is not a millionaire in any way whatsoever. And she's a threat. And those threats are eliminated. They're eliminated either politically assassinated or physically assassinated.
You look at people like Harry, John Kerry, you look at the Bushes, all of these people, you know what I'm saying? They come from these families, and I don't know how recent it is, but, you know, they are the ones who put their sons and daughters, groom them to be politicians and quote-unquote leaders or the ruling class. So, you know, I don't think we can separate the two today.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think that it's what's so painful about the American political system and the American state as the public eye of the state is that it exists as such a farce of itself. It's such a parody of itself that it's become to the point where it's a goddamn comedy show. It's fodder for Leno, and it's that simple. And it's the same way in England. Politicians are a joke. They're a joke to most everybody. When we talk about the state, I guess we have to discuss the deeper implications of the state, and that's much farther than politicians. It's much further than even cops or any of those things. We've self-identified, and that's where patriotism comes in. And this idea, this defense of the state and the flag, is so internalized that there are people willing, Travis, to stand in front of that bank with guns without pay.
How did it become internalized?
I think it's that master-slave mentality.
And this is the reason, one of the reasons we created the Black Talk Media Project, which you know us by Black Talk Radio, but we're actually a nonprofit here in North Carolina. We're starting youth programs to teach youth the power of the media and how it controls their minds. So that's what I'm getting at. And whether it was for partisan reasons or whatnot, but that person who said that Fox News or News Corp is the media wing of the Republican Party, they hit it dead on the nail. Roger Ailes comes from the Nixon administration. You know, he's an old pro at political propaganda. And so that's what I'm trying to say, is that through the use of media is how they get these I'm going to be kind, but how they get these, let's say, impressionable people to act against their own self-interest and to go stand out there in front and guard somebody else's property, even though they don't have a vested interest. We see it all the time. Look at Fox News, you know, how they really, really wave the flag, and it's a constant symbolism and all of this. So that's what I'm trying to say, is that is how they control the minds of the masses, is through these media apparatus.
I think it's definitely a strong part of it, yeah.
I completely agree. And, dude, you find me – Rabble Rouse, here's my challenge. You find me some dude who one time said, I am willing to die for Bank of America. They are an inspiration to me and my family. I am willing – no, you won't find it. You'll find guys who are, say, I'll defend my country, and I'm willing to die for my country. You'll find plenty of
that. And that's my point, Travis. That's my point, is the state has been put into place to give people this semblance of having a vested interest. No, you're not defending us. You're defending the union. You're defending your country. Meanwhile, we're going to profit greatly from it, and we're going to make use of your life as a resource. But don't look at us. It's the state you're defending. Just wrap yourself in that flag and shut the fuck up and be a good patriot. That's what we're seeing.
Even though they may not go out there and guard it themselves or put themselves in the line, what they will do is sit back and pollute public discourse and cheerlead for them. You know what I'm saying? It's the old trick of divide and conquer.
Oh, sure. I mean, you know, and by the way, there's always been the state came about first. Okay, that was the first organization to spring up. And there's a reason, by the way, why Rockefeller and the other robber barons were so interested in the strongly communist countries. They were really interested in Russia. They were really interested in China.
Well, but
because
but
they
wait,
could get,
but wait, but
because
wait,
listen
wait.
To me, they
came about first?
State, that they could get state granted. I'm saying the state came well before corporatism and capitalism.
Okay, well,
the
corporations,
state,
as you know it, is just a state. It's a state granted name upon those who control the resources. But the Rockefellers, these people, these empirical economic forces have survived and been around before and after the fall and rise of more states than you and I even know about.
And by the way, Robert, I got to interrupt for one second. I'm sorry, but the state has never fallen. It's just been the staff has changed. But the state has never
fallen.
And
that's my point. And that's my point is that the state will be there in any way whatsoever as the public eye upon what big business is going to do. And it always has been so.
And what I'm saying is that is wildly incorrect because you're assuming that big business was in existence in ancient China.
Absolutely. The hoarding of resources has been around since the beginning of any empire. That's what creates an empire. An empire is created not because there's a need to hoard resources. It's created because the resources have been hoarded.
But an empire is not a business. An empire functions on force. The textbook
and a business also functions on force. It just functions on force making use of the tools of the state.
Which, yeah, exactly. And you take the state away, and those tools go away. You can't
those
have
tools, them. But just because you take tools away doesn't mean that they don't have other tools at their disposal.
Dude, if taxes went away tomorrow, right? Like if no one had to.
Well,
pay taxes,
okay. Here's the real question. Then let's cut all this ideological argument. Let's cut the philosophy. Let's cut the bullshit. Can you smash something which is not what's the word I'm looking for? Which is inanimate, something which does not really exist, something ethereal. Can you smash the state, being that the state is deeply embedded, it's a thought process, it's a mind thing. You can take away public buildings and governments, but can we really smash that tomorrow? No. Can we go out and smash the bulldozers that are taking down the trees? Yes, absolutely. Can you cause economic damage? Yes, you can cause great economic damage to these corporations, which does cause improvements. Now, with the state, can you bring down the state? Absolutely not. You can't bring down the state tomorrow. There's not a chance in hell that you're going to bring down the state because it's so deeply embedded that people will defend the state. Will they defend the U.S. Bank? No, they won't. But they'll defend the state, which the U.S. Bank uses to protect itself.
Yeah, and when U.S. Bank goes away, it'll be replaced by some other institution because that's what the state's biggest selling points are, is there's huge incentive for people to organize and attempt to scramble for the gun. Okay, that's what it is. So if it's not a business, rabble rouser, it's going to be something else. It's going to be.
You know
it's
what
not
that
maybe.
Something else is? You know, and I see what you're getting at. And when you say the state, you know, for the purposes or what we've been focusing on in this on this program or in this discussion is secular entities. But wouldn't you say, I mean, look at the Vatican, man. Look at church. Look at religious institutions. And that's the institution that's probably been around before these country states.
Oh, absolutely. There's absolutely no coincidence that every nation state has used, except for communist states, have used religious leaders as
right.
token spokespeople.
Totally.
I mean, there's no
totally.
Coincidence at all
right.
whatsoever.
Yeah.
But,
I mean,
no,
we've
what
made
I'm
it
saying,
to the point where
saying,
there's American flags hanging in the Christian churches, for fuck's sake. I mean, we're talking about Christ,
saying,
who was one of the most rebellious anti-statists in any religious theology in history, and here in go to the church and there's a fucking American flag the size of of a house.
Totally.
You know, it's disgusting.
Right. But that's what I'm saying, though. I mean, especially the Catholic Church. Wouldn't you say the Catholic Church? I mean, that's a perfect example of a blending of state and religion. Because as I understand it, they
and
have
economy,
a basket
yeah.
war. Yeah, and an economy also. So
yeah,
if you
the opinion of hierarchy.
A
well,
federal,
I mean,
yeah.
The hierarchy begins and ends. It's the Alpha and the Omega. With the separation of God from man. Shamanistic religions didn't have a distinct separation between God and man. There was a constant discourse between God and man. The Catholic Church comes around, and the ideas of this Western religion is that there are certain people who have the ability to speak for God to you, and God
right.
is above you, and you have to listen to me. And that's the initial separation, taking the divinity out of the individual, is the initial hierarchy that begins and allows for all other hierarchies to exist. Mm-hmm. Once we've lost our divinity, we've lost all ability to be self-actualized.
Yeah, no, and, you know, and it's really interesting because, like, all the religious traditions all have these notions of unity, you know, and that's when you get into kind of the more mystic theology. And, you know, we were talking about this, Rabble Rouser, at the very beginning of the show, of just the, you know, our specific acts of separation from everything. From, you know, it's a big deal to be, you know, like, it's, you know, it's shocking to me that it's a big deal that I've been learning recipes and how to cook food. You know what I mean? Like, fucking
right,
shocking.
Right.
That's ridiculous, right? And so, you know,
right.
Not only are we separated from, you know, just from our food, but we're also separated from, you know, our spirit. And, you know, I don't like to go there because, you know, the atheists are cool too, but, you know, like, but, you know, an atheist can be a spiritual human being, and to be separated from, you know, from things to such a degree is definitely poisonous. You know, I just think that what's happening is that what I see happening in specifically in anarchism and in resistance and action is action. Actions are based on ideas. Our ideas are made up of terms. And I think that in a lot of ways our terms are maybe skewed, and I think that our enemies are wrong. I mean, you're right. You're right. You're absolutely right. We can't fight head on with government. Are you kidding me? They'll fucking win really, really, really quickly. That doesn't mean that there aren't things to do in terms of action to begin starving the state and taking it away, because from my point of view, I want their tool to go away, and I want them to be left alone, because I want them to go down. From my point of view, I want these guys to go down just as bad as you, Rabble Rouser, just as bad as you. From my point of view, the best way to do that in the big picture is to take away the organization that is always there protecting them, that they use for their protection. That organization needs to go away.
And I think no matter what either of us want to see go down, I think that we could probably both agree that armed insurrection is great in some cases for necessity, out of necessity. I mean, maybe you won't agree with that. I'm saying that armed insurrections, they have proven to work in certain cases to protect and immediately defend yourself. Now, in the longevity of them, I don't know. I just don't know about that.
But sure, I'm with you.
The initial change has to be a change of consciousness. It has to be how we view things. Now, white supremacy is something that has been around that far usurps historically all of these state ideas, economic ideas, religious ideas. White supremacy is there because people accept the idea of white. There's this all-encompassing idea of what white is. And so when I say kill whitey, I mean it. And I'm saying kill the idea of what white is. White is this privileged idea of somehow maintaining control or power or privilege where others don't, simply based upon your skin color. It has nothing to do with if you're white or not, if you're privileged, because obviously white supremacy exists for those who are in power and who are supreme, and they want to maintain that white supremacy at all costs, and they use the ideas of race to make us feel that we're connected or separated from power. And so just as racism is a tool that needs to be dismantled in your mind, hierarchy needs to be dismantled in your mind across the board, you know, male-female separation, straight queer separation. All of these ideas of separation and division have to be dismantled internally. They cannot be dismantled by smashing anything that exists.
Well, you know how one of the places that you're going to have to start is with the church, and I hate to keep going back to that, but that is really, really implanted into people's minds. When you hear people give so much praise and they elevate these pastors, or, you know, I'm not talking about racism, but I'm just talking about mind control, and you're talking about getting rid of hierarchies and things of that nature, thinking that there always has to be somebody in control. Now, yeah, we know that the Catholic Church has always taught that, you know, only certain people can interpret the word of God and you have to confess your sins to a man. But still, even in the Protestant religions, you know, that elevation is given to the pastor or the preacher to the point to where he's even worshipped. So it's constantly reinforcing to them, whereas my reading of Christianity or the teachings of Jesus Christ is the very purpose of Jesus Christ coming here and establishing his ministry was to eliminate the need for a go-between a person and God so that you could directly talk to God and
absolutely
ask for forgiveness and all that. But, I mean, that's where you have to start if you're going to tear down these walls and outside of the church.
I absolutely agree that, like I said, that's the first hierarchy that's been instilled, and the most meaningful one is the separation of God. Now, if we attach all of the secondary and tertiary things that have been added to that, such as the God is male. You know, how that came about, I have no idea, being that all of the aspects that we learn about of God are inherently feminine aspects, you know, the ability to create life, the nurturing abilities, the loving abilities, those things are things that we know as to be feminine aspects, but somehow God's a male. The idea that Jesus is somehow the first ever white man to be born in the Middle East at that time with blonde hair and blue eyes, that's pretty phenomenal. I mean, you see white Jesus in every church. So these race ideas, these sexual inequality ideas, the gender biases, all of these things stem from that I definitely agree, that the religious theocracy that exists. But in our daily lives, I think that we need to be talking less philosophy and more on-the-ground action, what can be done. Because we can philosophize all day which one needs to be smashed first, but bottom line is it doesn't really matter which one goes first. I just want to see them all go.
Well, I look at it like this. I can walk and chew bubble gum at the same time. I mean, I have my area. I'm focused. You know, you have individuals working towards the same goals, but they have different areas of expertise. And so there are many different departments in the Army. You know, there are many branches of the Army, different units specialized in different things. You have your communication battalions, you have your infantry battalions, you have your aviation battalions. And so all people have to do is just focus on the area that they're good at. I like media. So that's what I'm doing. I think that media controls everything or is a big part of those social controls. And so it is my mission to teach youth how they are impacted by this media and how their actions and thought patterns are being controlled by corporate media, and teaching them, how to be immune to it. But not only that, but then to turn it around and use it as a tool against corporate media, to build alternative media platforms that aren't corporately controlled.
Right. The first step, I think, would be, or not a first step, but a good tool in teaching with that would be to tell the kids, you know, you want to learn about media, turn the TV off for a week, turn your radio off for a week. If you want to listen to music, listen to music your friends make, listen to those things, but turn off all external input for a week, and then come back, and then let's discuss it and see where your mindset is just in that 1 week period. And it makes a huge difference. I mean, we're so inundated with distractions and with information. We have constant information coming into our heads that we don't have any time to disseminate from that information what is good and what is bad. And I've really found that being without internet access constantly has been huge for my ability to understand myself a little better and not just be reactionary, number one. But it's a strange thing when you start eliminating those things for good or bad. You know, those tools can be used for good or bad, but if you eliminate them and then go from that ground point of, okay, I don't need that anymore, but I can use that when I choose to, I think that's a good step.
Well, and I really like, Scotty, your words because it does remind us of some perspective, because I think everyone, when we get into especially when we take radical positions about things, or quote-unquote radical positions about the socioeconomic system we find ourselves in, there's a tendency to, I would say, kind of compartmentalize ourselves and build enemies where we don't really need to. I mean, now, Rabble Rouser and I, obviously, you hear us getting fired up. We're actually very close friends. We enjoy engaging.
We actually live pretty
other.
Close to each other, but we don't see each other because somebody doesn't like taking the bus.
Oh, snap. Guilty. But I think, you know, Scotty, you help serves to remind us all that, I mean, I fucking hate big business, dude. I had an awesome meltdown on the show a few weeks ago about Walmart. I mean, dude, I hate them. And that's why you don't hear me speaking out against guys like, you know, Trey Arrow, against, eco-activists who really take some extreme measures. Because I'm kind of sympathetic.
Yeah, we know. I think that whether you're the big argument right now in some of the radical communities is violence versus nonviolence and what that looks like. And I think that there has to be a unification of understanding that while there are various tactics we can take, there's tactics, there's strategies, and they're two different things. The tactics may be different. But what you're saying, Scotty, that I 100% agree with is that we do have to focus on where our strengths lie and then understand that we don't have the same strengths, but if we're together, we're much stronger. And if we can fight on the, if we can fight without excluding other groups that have those certain strengths, you know, if we can fight in a way that doesn't exclude those things, but what that requires is that also requires, like, it's really hard for radical organizations and liberal organizations to work together because of liberal organizations' inherent tendency to defend and apologize for the state or apologize for the master. In some way, they're advocating reform, and that's really hard thing to swallow. And I find myself not working with them based upon experience of being turned into the cops by them for things that I didn't even do, you know, as a security measure that they took to garner privilege with the police. And that's the fear that we have to understand that exists. But as far as, like, having different tactics, yeah, it's absolutely necessary to strengthen and work in the field that you 100% believe in. The Take Back the Land Miami, when he spoke, a lot of his questions were like, well, once you get the families in the house, what does your organization do to help them get job training and such? He's like, no, you don't understand. We exist to steal houses from the bank and put people in them and then defend them from the cops. Next, okay, well, does your organization help people get food once they're in the house? No, you don't understand. Our organization exists to steal houses from the bank and put people in them and then defend them from the cops when the cops show up. And people couldn't understand and grasp the idea of a specialized organization. Like, look, we serve one purpose. You, if you want find a reason to start another organization, we'll work with you. If you want to start collecting food and fill these pantries up with food once we squat these houses, amen, I'll give you a call. As soon as we get the family in, you can bring the food in. But
right.
We have to understand that we have different strengths, and we don't have to encompass all of these things at once and still have a tertiary understanding of them. You know, we can understand.
And if you try to, you know, the old term about spreading yourself thin, you know, you can't, what's that old phrase, the jack of all trades and master of none? I think we had to become masters, you know what I'm saying, in particular areas, but networking with other people, like you just said, okay, your organization, what you do is take houses from banks and then protect them from the house. And so then you got a family in there that needs food, so that's when you give them a referral to the local food bank or whatever organ, Lowe's and Fish's, whatever. You know what I'm
right.
saying? So everybody has their place, and they're all working towards the same ends, and we just had to see how we can
well, what that's
going to
require, I think we should get a convergence going that isn't specified, where we have speakers from all different realms of resistance coming to speak, but they have to speak from an understanding that they're going to only speak about the one thing that they're there to speak about, and speak about it clearly, and state, mm-hmm. we have to have an understanding before we have any kind of meetings like that, that, like, look, I'm not here to devalue any of the other people that are going to be speaking for what they're speaking for. I'm here to simply talk about what I'm doing. And what you can do if you have interest in this field. And if not, then listen to the next speaker. And I'm sure that between a group of speakers that we could pull together, we could have people that find interest in some field. And if not, they could create their own. That's the amazing thing about this world, is that given the freedom, people can create many new ideas and new things where they can be creatively revolutionary or creatively resist.
I mean, you know, there's a saying that, you know, freedom works. I mean, look at the three of us are three very different guys and have a lot of different ways of seeing the world. But look, man, three of us, we're all essentially sitting in a virtual space and we're interacting and we're laughing and we're I feel like I'm, you know, every show we do, I always feel like I leave it wiser. And so, you know, and again, I go back to the beginning of the show.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Oh, Jesus, narcissist, motherfucker. But, you know, I think that's incredibly important because we box ourselves in so ideologically. And you know, and I think also it's important that the realization that, you know, really, I mean, you can only 100% know that you can change yourself. And then you can try persuading other people. And I think that in large part due to the information age, we get into this psychology of changing the world. And I don't think our brains are really really kind of wired for that kind of magnitude of shit. That's why I think you got to be kind of a madman to become president and shit, because you got to be able to kill thousands of people and not give a shit and go to sleep at night. You know, I don't think our brains naturally wired for that kind of madness. And I think to a certain degree,
And I think there's a large amount of control put in there when they separate us from our ability to have land base. I think that's one of the most fundamental ideas of control of a large group of people is take away their ability to self-actualize on their land. We're all renters, and if we're not renters, we're paying a mortgage to a bank, and we have these lands that we aren't attached to. And if we could attach to our lands, then we have a ground point from which to fight, and we have an understanding of what we're fighting for and where we're fighting. And if we could form that connection to that land, however that may look, whether that's squatting an entire neighborhood and then locking it down and saying, you know, this is our neighborhood, we make our own rules at this point, which also happened in Miami. They built a squatters village where they self-governed in this squatters village by consensus. And it worked until 6 months into it, a mysterious fire enveloped and took down the whole squatters village. It's funny how mysterious fires break out when black people self-actualize. But, it does. And it's amazing how firefighters and fire departments tend to be a little late when those kind of things go down. But those mysterious fires will come up. But if we have a land base from which to act from, we have something we're actually defending. And that makes the argument less ideological, less philosophical, and more out of necessity. And then we know what we need, because there's absolutely no way that being in the Pacific Northwest, we need the same thing that Scotty needs. You're in North Carolina, right, Scotty?
Right.
Yeah, there's absolutely no way that our needs are the same as your community's needs. No way in hell. We have different land bases. We have different things that we need. But the simple ideas of the fighting can come together on terms of we're fighting for what we need, you fight for what you need, and inherently we're fighting together, and we're fighting the same fight, because the fight's against occupation. I mean, I think, and I'm assuming that's what the fight is against in all forms, occupation, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, and I just saw, little things that I noticed that I, in my mind, count as resistance against the machine in their own way are this one network of impromptu this impromptu network of mutual aid that these cats have set up at freeagents.com. And, they set it up using PayPal and shit, but they set this up themselves and were able to give this cat, $5,000 to pay his rent and to feed him. And these are the things that people do in the context of freedom. The people, it's a microcosm, I know. Speaking of which,
let's do a little plug for some comrades of ours who are still in serious need of help. If you look up Friends of Tortuga, I believe it's friendsoftortuga.blogspot.com. I may be wrong. If one of you guys, Travis, if you wouldn't mind opening your window and looking for this, look up the Tortuga Collective. You'll find the Friends of Tortuga. Tortuga is our comrade that used to have a segment on our show, the Cannon Fodder, Mike Cannon. Of course, they're facing federal charges of terrorism and all of these things for Twittering. And they are in serious need of financial support at this point because they've gotten themselves they've been put into a position where they need to pay for legal defense because they're looking at some serious time, and this is a very important case
for Twittering,
yes. And during the G20, it's a pretty somewhat famous case.
I read about that, yes.
Yeah, these guys are facing serious charges, and the implications of this are much deeper than just these guys going to prison, because that may not be the case. Apparently, charges – I haven't had a computer, so I don't know, but I think charges have been dropped in Pittsburgh. So the Pennsylvania charges have been dropped, but there's still these pending charges from their raid on their home in New York, and they're closed. Nobody knows what they are yet. It's sealed charges, so that hasn't been released as of this
point. Browser, what's the website?
Look up Tortuga, Tortuga. Look up like a Tortuga Collective. You should be able to find a blog.
On the website, 141 New York NYC.blogspot.com. Does that sound right to you?
No, that doesn't sound right. I think it's Friends of Tortuga or something like that. Okay. You might be able to link to it from those other ones. I don't know, but you'll find the Friends of Tortuga blogspot. And there's a PayPal link on there to donate whatever. If it's $1, if it's $5, if it's a couple hundred dollars, it's really easy to come up with those things in a pinch too. I know it sounds like a lot of money, but it really does make a big difference. Every little bit helps, and that's what mutual aid is, because these guys, they really dedicated their lives to helping people stay safe on the streets, and that's really what it was about, was keeping people safe, keeping people out of the hands of the violent authorities that were in Pittsburgh. I was in Pittsburgh. And it was violent. It was extremely violent, and it was oppressive. And I was chemically tortured. I was shot with rubber-coated steel bullets. I had batons, whizzed by my head. And these guys did their small part to help us try to evade that that kind of repression. And what they did was perfectly legal, but they're being, of course, because they're anarchists, they're being put on the chopping blocks. And but the other implications of this are so deep that we can't really talk about them on the show or in a public setting, but just understand that once the state starts using these tools of repression against groups like that, that they're building a network of communications to crush all forms of dissent. It's something they've been doing for forever. The fact that we happen to be white is the only thing that saved us up to this point, because if we were black leaders, they would have killed us in our sleep like they did Fred Hampton. But the resistance is getting so strong in certain cases that it's not far off from that. It's definitely not far off from assassinations beginning to take place. And we've seen it happen many times. So, you know, people just pay attention to this stuff, support them, because they're really dedicating their lives to trying to make a better world, and they're not using violent means or anything like that. They're using simple legal communication tools.
Yeah, that's a pretty interesting case. I think I had mentioned it on or tweeted about it, and I heard somebody say, you know, how the government here is coming out, or state is coming out against what they were doing, but at the same time, you know, they were encouraging our Iranians to, you know, use Twitter and stuff, doing, you know, the protests.
Absolutely.
And stuff go over there. But you know, I always thought, like, these roadblocks that they set up, which they call them DWI checkpoints, which I believe are unconstitutional.
Drawing blood?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I believe that they are unconstitutional because you're being stopped. You know, they're searching you. If they look in your car with a flashlight, to me, that's a search without
Absolutely.
A warrant, you know.
Absolutely.
And so I've always thought about, you know, what if somebody – set up a communications network, and certainly Twitter is something that could be used to where, you know, people would report in to this website or where the roadblocks were so that other people could avoid them. Would that be legal or illegal or whatnot? And so to me, it's not illegal, because it wouldn't be illegal in my mind, because the people who are avoiding these checkpoints haven't necessarily committed a crime. So it's not
right.
Like,
well, there's a gentleman who had RaiseTheFist.com a few years back, who served a lengthy prison system for running a website where he disseminated information, and they arrested him under charges from a bill that was passed during the Clinton administration that he was forwarding these ideas of use of incendiary devices and whatnot, and this young man went to prison. I think his name is Austin Sherman, or Sherman Austin, something like that. You can Google that up, RaiseTheFist.com. No crime was committed. He was simply using the Internet to disseminate information, and he went to prison for this. This happens all the time. You know, it's not a joke. It's not just because you're paranoid doesn't mean they're not out to get you, is the way it's got to go, you know. But by the same token, I think that a real testament to any kind of ideas of movement is that there still are people like the Black Talk Media Network, and like Burn, and like the Fightin' Cock Flyer, and these shows that are out there that are willing to risk that by telling the truth at all costs. You know, people say Alex Jones. You know, Alex Jones is a CIA plant. The fact that he's been telling the truth for all these years without facing any kind of repressions, it's proof of that to me. And all he does is tear down small insurrectionary groups. He spends most of his time telling people that anarchists are cops, and that you know, these small insurrectionary groups are somehow connected to the banking establishments. And he's fucking ridiculous. He's a cop. But
yeah,
there are people out there still willing.
About him, yeah. I used to subscribe to his website, Prison Planet, years ago. I think this was like back in 2000. It was before 9/11 happened in 2001 that I came across his website. And I used to subscribe to it, but over the years, man, I started having questions about him also. So it was just interesting.
He's a white male power trip. I mean, as long as he can. His whole deal is he needs to be able to maintain the power. Like, he wants white men to stay in power, and that's it, you know.
So, guys, we have about 60 seconds left in our show. Scotty, do you want to give one last plug to your show and then what you guys do there real quick before we sign off for the night?
Well, we actually have an independent radio platform at blacktalkradionetwork.com, and you can find one of our distribution points here on the platform, blogtalkradio.com. And it says Black Talk Radio, but everybody is welcome. We have a very diverse membership base.
Very, very cool. Everyone, in the month of December, Rob Walzer and I will be broadcasting live from Muddy Waters Cafe in Portland, Oregon. We're working on getting that all set up. We'll have live guests. It's going to be fucking awesome. It has been a great show tonight. Live free, eliminate the state, and Rabble Rouser, I love it. You got any final words for our peeps?
I would just say when it comes to revisionist history and whatnot, Howard Zinn always says to make if we are to use history, we should use it creatively, and the best way to do that is to find the history of those who speak from your perspective. And it might be hard to find, but dig for it, find it, and find comfort in the fact that the resistance has been going. It's never died. This is not a new resistance. Just learn from our elders and maintain that resistance. And if we maintain as long as they have, we're going to win.
Awesome. Well, thanks for listening, everybody tonight, everybody in the chat room. Scotty, thanks for being with us. You were great. We wish everyone a great night and have a great week.
Good night.
All right, take care, everybody.
Good night.